right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys, time to welcome Ramsey Baroud back to the show here. PalestineChronicle.com is the website, and of course, he's the author of My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, and the latest is These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. And we republish almost everything he writes at antiwar.com as well. Welcome back to the show, Ramsey. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Interesting piece. 100 Years of Shame, Annexation of Palestine Began in San Remo. Well, where's San Remo?
Well, San Remo is this beautiful, dreamy town at the in northern Italy, the Italian Riviera, and it has, despite of the fact that it's a very beautiful place, it is associated with one of the most sinister agreements ever signed regarding, kind of post-World War I arrangements that took place between the victorious countries. And the idea behind it is to divide the spoils of the Ottoman Empire to various countries. And Iraq and Syria were divided between the British and the French, respectively, while Palestine was given to the Zionists, no questions asked. And now, what is the difference between San Remo and the Balfour Declaration? I mean, those who are history buffs would, know that in 1917, Britain has already given Palestine or promised Palestine to the Zionists if they are to help Britain during World War I, and they did. So why is San Remo a big deal? Well, because Balfour was a mere promise by a country that did not even occupy Palestine at the time. San Remo was the so-called international community, their version of the international community at the time, their agreement and their confirmation that the Balfour Declaration is valid, and therefore Palestine goes to the Zionists. And that was almost exactly 100 years ago. At the time, Palestinians were promised, as they argued in the article, ever so politely requesting, from this new Israeli state, Zionist state, to be kind to its Arab inhabitants, exactly like the Balfour Declaration had requested that the inhabitants of Palestine should not, should still enjoy certain civil rights and so forth. And of course, nobody actually followed up on that. I mean, it wasn't really a political commitment of any kind. It was just a gesture. But the actual political diktat was for Palestine to be transferred gradually to the Zionist movement. A discussion about Palestine only happened later when the British began realizing that they kind of made a promise that it was very difficult for them to sustain. Arab governments at the time, with all of their, deficiencies and problems, resisted that. Not so many people in the international community, especially in the South, looked favorably on some faraway empire to grant a piece of land that doesn't belong to it to another nation. So they began thinking about, well, maybe we can find some sort of an arrangement that would kind of make everybody happy. So Israel, which wasn't yet Israel, was granted about 55% of Palestine, the arable land, the fertile land, the coastal cities, and all of this. And the Arabs were to be given about 45%, mostly the desert towns, Naqab in the south, the Gaza coastal area and what is now the West Bank and a little bit more. Naturally, Palestinians protested. I mean, if someone comes and takes over the United States and gives it to some other country, and then they say, well, I'm going to give a portion of that country to the local inhabitants, you're going to still find it ridiculous. Even if 1% of your country is annexed and given to someone else, you will find this outrageous. The sad thing is that mainstream historians who kind of saw history from an Israeli point of view blame the Palestinians or the Arabs at the time by saying, well, they missed this historic opportunity. They should have accepted it. See, there would have been a Palestinian state by now. And of course, this is just not accurate historically. It's not accurate at all in the sense that, number one, no one would have accepted that arrangement under any circumstance at the time. Palestinians did not realize, honestly, that the international community was so weak-willed and that the Arabs would betray them and turn their backs on them to this extent. And nobody could read what the future is going to hold, the actual power of the Zionist movement. But the other important aspect in all of this is the fact that this promised Jewish state really had no intention of ever honoring that Palestinian state demarcation anyway. And the proof to that is, well, aside from the fact that they kind of their leader said it out loud, you know, Ben-Gurion and Begin and these others. But more importantly is that when the war of 1948 happened, when the British ended their mandate, so-called mandate over Palestine, the Zionist forces that went to kind of take over the large spaces that were assigned to them by Western powers, they took a lot more than that, right? So they went delve deeply into this supposed Palestinian state, and they took over. Now, another important thing is that there were all sorts of mechanisms that were there to ensure that that Jewish state is going to be ready for its new status. So there was an administrative system, there was a government in waiting. The British were already helping the Zionists achieve everything they needed to achieve, training their military, their armies, and so forth, so that they could actually, within, you know, a moment's notice, they create a state. Well, what did the Palestinians have? Nothing. No preparedness, no army, no administrative systems. So it was just really, as we say, ink on paper. It was never really meant to be utilized in any way. And you know what? I'm going to be a little bit generous and add a fourth point here and say, let's say that our ancestral leadership made this terrible mistake and say, no, we don't want 45% of Palestine, and they should have accepted it. Let's just go with that. Agree. We had 72 years, the anniversary of the Nakba is going to be, or the destruction of Palestine in 1948 is coming in a week. We had 72 years for that historical mistake to be corrected, and Palestinians have been begging for their independent state. And there are all sorts of international resolutions that are backing their request. How come there hasn't been enough will in the international community to make that happen after the passing of all of these years?
Mm. Well, it's worth mentioning, too, as Sheldon Richman wrote about in his book, Coming to Palestine, about how the Zionists in 48 made a secret deal with the King of Jordan so that he would take the West Bank, so that the Palestinians wouldn't even have a chance to build a state of their own. That was the first major setback there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this point, if there was really ever any intentions of giving them a state, why were you conspiring with Jordan and creating the kind of scenario that would allow this state to never, ever actualize?
Yeah. Well, and the heart of it, Gaza, for whatever reason, is, I mean, just because of, I guess, the size of the land, and it's, you know, separated apart from Jerusalem and all of that. It's the West Bank that gets, you know, the primary attention as the possible place where a Palestinian state would exist, in conjunction with Gaza at some point or something. But the idea was that East Jerusalem would be the capital of it. And I know that you've argued that it's way too late for that. If there ever was a possibility of that, that possibility expired a long time ago. But now we have the so-called deal of the century from Donald Trump and Jared Kushner. And we have the renewed Netanyahu government in alliance with his primary opponent, Benny Gantz. And they're agreed that it's time to go ahead and start to, go ahead and annex another major proportion of the West Bank, the entire Jordan River Valley, and essentially all the land where there's not already a Palestinian town, all of Area C, I think, is to be transferred over to their sovereignty. And so I guess, you know, fill in the finer points of that as you understand them, please. And then, you know, tell us, where does that leave us here?
Well, Scott, I mean, we understand that colonialism is essentially theft. I mean, we have all of these fancy terminologies we use: colonialism, decolonization, annexation, so forth and so on. It's you know, someone taking someone else's land and ethnically cleansing their people and, you know, murdering them if they resist, imprisoning, torturing in the process. It's really all about that piece of land. That's what I'm trying to say. It's about the olive grove, the mountain that needs to be completely erased, and a road needs to be built, you know, access to natural resources, access to water. In the case of the West Bank, it's really largely about the water, because a third of Israel's water comes from the West Bank aquifer, and so forth. So it's really all about taking land away from Palestinians. Now, throughout the years, Israel has come up with all of these, and again, this is really not unique to Israel as a colonial power. It is something that all colonial powers have in common, which is constantly coming up with ideas of how do we take this land away from the people, but coining it in such a way that would allow us to do it maybe in a polite fashion, or in a way that in our minds, at least, it's defensible. So when they took over the West Bank in 1967, they said they were taking over the West Bank for strategic reasons. They were building settlements for strategic reasons. Then eventually, when the Likud, right-wing party, came to power in the late 70s, it became for religious and spiritual reasons. So they start taking over parts of Qalqilia, Tulkarem in the north, Jenin, you know, so forth and so on. Jericho, because of its proximity to Jordan, Israel has to be defensible. We need defense built. We need no-go zones. We need no-fire zones. We need military closed zones. And so, and of course, areas were taken for natural expansion of the settlements. Hey, our settlers, those illegal armed people who moved from Israel to the West Bank, I mean, they breed, they have children, they have families, they have, you know, these families grow, and therefore their need for housing, their need for agriculture, their need for water, that grows as well. So they began expanding and so forth and so on. Now, this is the latest, and in my opinion, one of the final strokes that the Zionist colonialist project is trying to enact, and that is annexation. So there's no difference whatsoever, really, in my mind between any of these pretenses. But annexation has this kind of slightly different quality, which is, okay, I colonized, I officially occupied, but now I need to translate this into something that I keep for good. So that's, you know, essentially what annexation is. It means it's now part of my territory, legally, per my own law. Right. Annexation is something they have been talking about for many years. This precedes Netanyahu and Benny Gantz and all of this. It just, they never had the right political environment that would allow them to do so. U.S. administration with all of their prejudices and blind moral unconditional support to Israel all these years always kind of found the issue of annexation of the West Bank troubling. Yes, they annexed, when Israel annexed Jerusalem, they supported, the Congress supported that, the administration supported that, but they said, we are not going to agree to it yet until an overall peace agreement is reached between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So that kind of, you know, Jerusalem had this precarious status as far as they are concerned. But the West Bank in particular, the various U.S. administrations kind of warned against what they call unilateral steps taken by any party, including Israel. So Israel continued to cement its occupation, to build settlements using American money, mind you, but it has not yet officially annexed any part of the West Bank. Now, the fact that the U.S. administration is telling Israel, Pompeo said it out loud, he said, this is your business, really, more or less. You know, you want to annex, you annex. The timing is your timing and the schedule is yours. And there is more or less consensus within Israel that it's time for annexation. Arabs are so busy with their terrible wars in Libya and Syria and Yemen. The Saudis are giving the nod anyway. The Emiratis don't really care. And these are the people with the money in the region, and they are the people who are making things happen. In fact, they are normalizing with Israel during this time. And the Palestinian Authority is bankrupt. They have no money. They have no money, and they don't have any political power, really, aside from symbolic speeches and gestures at the United Nations. So what will happen? And here's the question that the Israeli government has been asking itself. We have been wanting to do this for decades, and we will never, ever have a better opportunity to annex than this. Why shouldn't we? So not only the right wing in Israel is believing in that, but also the center and parts of the left saying, you know, it's time. It's now or never. So when they talk about annexation, they are talking about over a third of the overall size of the West Bank and the entirety of the Jordan Valley. Some people are saying this could actually be the very final move of the Zionist colonialist project. I think not. I think they will not be happy even to see Palestinians with this tiny, tiny pocket of population. They need to find a way to restrict their movements, to create more no-go zones and so forth and so on. I think the ultimate aim of Zionism is the complete ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And this is actively happening anyway.
Yeah. Now, so I don't know if you saw this thing by Daniel Pipes, noted right-wing neoconservative hawk, who said that this is the wrong thing because I guess, you know, wherever, however he prioritizes it, you know, possessing Judea and Samaria, as they call it, is not so important to him. What is important to him is keeping a Jewish super duper majority inside so-called Israel proper, 80-20 or exactly whatever the percent is now. And as he puts it, sorry, but this is inviting the enemy into the country by essentially expanding the border around them without expelling them. And
right.
So it's a suicidal move from that point of view.
Right. And I you know, Daniel Pipes and I had our, you know, thing in the past where his crazy organizations have attacked me and my work. And I you
That's
know,
no surprise.
As you know, he's a notorious Zionist. But I found that article particularly interesting, Scott, in the sense that I did not know that the nature of conflict within the Zionist movement regarding annexation and theft of Palestine is actually that evolved, in the sense that, yes, we want the land, but we don't want the people. That has always been the arrangement from 1948, even before 1948. I mean, it's not like Zionist colonialism started in 1948. So there's been a lot of ethnic cleansing, a lot of conflicts and skirmishes that happened before that particular date. Until today, there's always been this issue that we annex, even if it's a tiny little piece of land and a farmer family in somewhere in the northern West Bank, you know, they're not going to take his land and keep the guy in there. They take their land and they kick the family out. That's how it works. And now you are talking about annexation and keeping the people in. And the reason that part branch of Zionism is thinking this way is back to my point, because there is this golden opportunity to annex that might not be repeated, But annexation, in you know, historically in Israel-Palestine happened, or occupation or colonialism happened in a much more incremental way. If I want to take over something, I need to make a plan 10, 15, 20, 30 years in advance in order for me to kick the people out gradually. But Trump is not going to be here forever. He's not going to be here for 30 years. How do I guarantee once Trump is gone, you know, at the end of the year or 5 years from now, that opportunity is still going to be there? So I'm willing to make an exception. You know, I'm speaking as Netanyahu right now. I am willing to make an exception. I am going to annex and worry about the ethnic cleansing later. Others saying, no, you need to worry about ethnic cleansing now and then annex later. And I think once that annexation happens, and I think it's going to happen, and I made that argument even before the Israelis settled their own differences, that it will happen, because from the, you know, exploitative nature of Zionism, you just don't miss this kind of opportunity, and there's no resistance, unfortunately, on the part of the Palestinian leadership that is actually measurable and tangible in any way. So they will. But once that is settled, there is going to be the question, now we annexed, the ratio of the population changed. What they call the demographic bomb is now much bigger than it was before. So what do we do? Do these people become voters? You know, I mean, they are already dealing with the issue that the joint list, the unified Arab parties within Israel, are now the third largest political force in the country. Can they afford adding hundreds of thousands to that? You know, so what do you do with this situation? And I think once annexation happens, the conversation is going to start switching to population, what they call population transfer. You know, essentially ethnic cleansing.
Yeah. So then the question is, did they build a railway and transfer the people of the West Bank to the Gaza Strip, or do they push them all to drown in the Jordan River, or march them into the Sinai Desert and claim that they belong to Egypt now? Or what do you think?
Well, they've done all of these things before, you know, more or less. I mean, there's always been this constant process.
And I guess there's nobody to stop them from doing this, right?
Right. So what Ilan Pappi referred to as incremental genocide, Israeli historian, excellent book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. So this ethnic, this incremental genocide has been happening for many, many years. So will that be an option? Now, I think there are... The main danger, in my opinion, is for Israel to find that Palestinian who, you know, they could impose as the leader after Mahmoud Abbas dies. Mahmoud Abbas is in his mid-80s at this point. So the question is, can they find that Palestinian leader who is willing to accept an Israel-imposed arrangement and kind of allow for so-called population transfer to happen as part of a supposed deal? I'm not really worried that the Palestinian people themselves are going to change their own perception of their own struggle, because for them it really doesn't matter. In fact, in Palestine, they don't even differentiate. We don't have terminologies. I mean, yes, academically we do, between colonialism, annexation, occupation, and so forth and so on. But in the everyday language that people use in the street, it's just Zionism being Zionism and stealing their land. So as long as Palestinians continue to perceive that process the same, their resistance is not going to change. But the real danger will... normalization between Israel and Arab countries continue to happen afoot, and using and bribing certain Palestinians to be part of that arrangement, could that change the formula for Israel? And I think this is the issue to look for within the Palestinian context of the story.
Yeah. I mean, they'd be crazy to try to do a big mass pogrom all at once, but I guess they could try to just piecemeal it out and say, well, we're going to consolidate the people from this town, have to now move all to Hebron, and then we'll get to removing the people from Hebron later on, that kind of thing.
Right. And just that also reminds me of another thing. There's another method that they usually create in order for this to happen: war. Because once you have a war, it becomes a lot easier to exact fundamental changes in this sort of thing, you know, demographic changes, ethnic cleansing, and nobody is actually paying attention to the ethnic cleansing. Everybody is talking about the war. So, for example, in northern Syria, when Aleppo was being contested by the various parties, yeah, we spoke about the refugees, but it was almost like a side note. Hundreds of thousands of people were fleeing all at once. It was a side note. Everybody was actually talking about the war itself. So Israel is very good at creating this kind of conflicts and dictating the discourse. We know their relationship with American and other Western mainstream media, dictating the discourse and blaming it on Palestinian terrorists who are doing this and that. Mm-hmm. And then when people are being pushed out, you know, it's going to be understood and written in media and history that, you know, these people were basically pushed out because of, you know, a war that was ignited by Palestinian terrorists. And so that's another option. They are always very good at manufacturing these fake conflicts out of nothing in order for them to achieve political ends.
Yep. And, you know, as long as the American media especially is willing to go along with the framing that whatever the Israelis are doing is always on the defensive, then that's absolutely the market that really matters.
Absolutely.
Hey, man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org.
Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to ScottHorton.org/donate.
Hey guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to ExpandDesigns.com/Scott. And say $500.
So obviously, worst case scenario seems to be, you know, the way things work around here a lot of the time. But then again, you know, the reason that people like Pipes are so worried, right, is that I guess the idea is that before they can expel the Palestinians, they'll have to give them rights first. That somehow, if they really officially annexed all this territory and officially, you know, took the pretension of a someday two-state solution off the table once and for all, that Palestinians really could just demand equal rights, and maybe the pressure would be on the Israelis to then let it be one state with equal rights instead of a, you know, chauvinist Jewish state at the expense of the Palestinians there. So, is there opportunity in this crisis, as Rahm Emanuel and Condoleezza Rice might say?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, as a one-stater, someone who's been advocating, you know, coexistence in one state, similar to the post-apartheid South Africa model, yes, of course, there is an opportunity. It's a point that we have been pushing for many years, that ultimately, no matter what you're doing, Israel, you keep slicing up people and territories and areas and playing politics and doing all of this. At the end of the day, you're Israelis, we are Palestinians, and we are still living in this area between the Jordan River and the sea. You know, no matter what kind of strange laws you keep manufacturing to prolong the divisions, at the end of the day, we are still there, and our numbers are growing, and nothing you have done to dissuade us or to ethnically cleanse the land, it hasn't changed. I mean, to really think about it from, you know, just a recent political example, the fact that Arab parties are the third largest force in the country, despite of everything that they have done, despite of the racist nation-state law that defines Israel by its Jewishness and denies Palestinian rights and Arab culture and language and everything, you still have the third largest political force in Israel, Arab. It's actually much larger than the Labour Party that essentially created Israel. It comes to show you that all of this nonsense is not going to work. You can't do it. It can't be done that you are going to kick, you know, 6-7 million people out and take over their land. They keep coming back. They keep growing. So this is not going to happen. So, of course, they are not going to annex the West Bank and the Jordan Valley with this idea that, hey, maybe we should give them equal rights and give them, kind of make them part of the state. They will come up with all sorts of sinister ideas, you know, to make the demographics work for them, right? But they will always fail. They will always fail because they have already failed when they had much greater opportunities to ethnically, I mean, in 1948 alone, the ethnically cleansed 800,000 people, and they still failed. You know, they can't just go and dump 1 million Palestinians to Jordan. I mean, that's not going to happen. At this point, the Palestinians will not leave and the Jordanians will not take them. You know, they were hoping that Palestinians in Gaza would leave to Sinai. And that did not happen. In fact, at one point, Palestinians were suffering so much under the siege and they were out of food and supplies. And then they managed to actually breach the wall between Gaza and Egypt. And hundreds of thousands of people rushed to Sinai. And people like me were watching. It's like, oh my goodness, the Zionist plot has finally worked. They pushed Gazans into Sinai. This happened a few years ago. And guess what happened? They went and they shopped. They bought food and medicine. And every single person was counted for, except of about 200 students who managed to get to Egypt and to other places to go to their universities. So this generation has learned so much from the mistakes of the previous generations. Neither the Arabs will accept having that kind of new refugee crisis, nor the Palestinians will even allow this to happen. So it's really the ball is now in the Israeli court. They are going to continue to play, you know, games with numbers and math, but eventually they will fail. They will fail because they have already done so for over 70 years.
All right, you guys, that's Ramzi Baroud. He's at original.antiwar.com/Ramzi-Baroud, and of course at PalestineChronicle.com. And his latest book is edited by him. It's These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. Thank you very much again, Ramzi.
Thank you for having me, Scott, and keep up the good work, man.
The Scott Horton Show, Antiwar Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.